Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Summer all year long. Pleasant in my paradise.
All right, today, our destination will be, we want to talk about financial offense and how to play financial offense versus financial defense, but financial offense as far as building, in our case, building tiny houses. But we're going to set the tone by why you need to learn how to play financial offense by building, learning how to build houses or whatever you want to build or create, through land theft, which is legal, land theft via legalized, what do you call it, legalized stealing. So some of the things we're going to cover before we get into the building part is how to legally steal real estate, although we don't recommend that, but you need to know about it. Land theft, what is housejacking, gentrification by property tax hijacking, code enforcement housejacking, gentrification literacy versus gentrification illiteracy, real estate property tax literacy versus real estate property tax illiteracy, and, of course, financial law offense, how to play it versus being on the defensive financially all the time. So we're going to play this clip, and then we'll go into open phone lines and building and stuff like that.
There are a lot of great $600,000, $1 million, $2 million homes.
Your biggest decision is, do I want to go to the beach or the pool, and what am I going to grill for dinner?
South Carolina, Hilton Head. What's going on there?
People with families, everybody loves Hilton Head.
One of the best ways for an American family to create intergenerational wealth is to own some land. It's in high demand, and they don't make it anymore. I'm standing on the beach of the beautiful island of Hilton Head, South Carolina, where after the Civil War, black people owned most of this. But over the decades, the land was lost. And to this day, we got black folks that are still fighting to keep their little piece of the American dream.
By 1910, African Americans owned around 16 million acres of land, much of it acquired through purchases and homesteading. But after years of violence, intimidation, and legal trickery, most of it was taken. Texas A&M law professor Thomas Mitchell has been tracking that loss for two decades.
Historically, we're talking about African Americans. Despite this incredible acquisition of land after the Civil War, most of that property was not considered prime real estate. For example, Hilton Head, South Carolina. Until 1950, Hilton Head was remote. There wasn't a bridge from the South Carolina mainland out to Hilton Head Island, and the island was owned by majority African Americans.
Right.
What does South Carolina do? They build a bridge. Real estate developers realize, oh, there's a great economic opportunity, and they have divisions of what has become Hilton Head.
The indigo, rice, and long staple cotton of the past have given way to the golf, tennis, and swimming of today's leisure society.
They started buying out individual families, and there's hardly any black landowners left. And what's just happened as our society has advanced, areas that were once considered the backwaters no longer are the backwaters.
We're on a mission right now to get this tangerine.
The vulnerability of black land isn't limited to the coastlines. It's widespread throughout the United States, even in my hometown of Tallahassee. Sandra Thompson learned just how hard it can be to maintain possession of land that developers want to get their hands on.
I remember growing up in Tallahassee.
Uh-huh.
This was the sticks. I went to school with people that lived out here. We'd be like, you live in the boonies, in the boondocks.
It's actually now zoned urban fringe.
Urban fringe.
Urban fringe.
People tried to buy it.
All the time.
Sandra's family were sharecroppers on this land. Her grandparents bought it in 1946 using money their son made serving in the military. But their will didn't clearly identify a single person who would inherit and manage the property.
When my grandmother passed away, it was left equally to her descendants. So that essentially created heirs property.
Heirs property. On the most basic level, what is it?
Ayers property is communal type property where your ancestors would have purchased the land, and once they passed away, it transfers to the next generation and their descendants. It's fractional ownership, a property that could be owned by 200 people. Any one of those heirs could sell their percentage. That new owner can go to the court and say, well, we can't agree on how to manage this land.
And force the rest of the folk to sell it, even if they don't want to?
Yeah. And so it was essential for us to move it out of heirs property status. And in that process, cost from probate to title clearing, close to about $10,000.
Wait, so you own the land, but then you had to pay $10,000 to own the land again?
Exactly. Because of the cost, a lot of families don't clear title to their property. And so then it keeps them in a vulnerable economic risk position.
African Americans disproportionately own heirs' property that every lawyer who was knowledgeable about this ownership form would tell them, run away. Do not ever own it under this structure. And so you're having a population sitting in this very vulnerable way, and oftentimes in a way that they don't understand how the law operates, sometimes until a lawsuit is filed.
This land been in our family for at least 125 years. Started with my great-grandfather. The land is, for me, a lot of memories, part of my roots. I was proud of the name Lewis. We worked to have something. And I guess we say we lost it.
The Lewis family owned 480 acres of land and a homestead in northern Louisiana. Because the land was heirs' property, several distant family members were able to sell their share of it to a local timber developer named James Tuggle. Tuggle forced the sale of the land that happened last year.
My great-great-grandfather raised 13 kids where that house sits. I mean, there are so many heirs tied into the Lewis properties, it'll make your head spin. Taxes were always paid on time. We were under the impression that could no one person from the family just up and sell any part of the property without anyone being notified.
Do you all know the relatives that sold their part?
I've only seen one once.
You in New York, wherever, going on with your life, you don't really know nothing about this little country spot right here. You don't know nothing about this here.
As part of the legal process, the forced sale of heirs' property has to be publicly announced. In the Lewis' situation, a local newspaper posted a notice in the weeks leading up to the auction.
This is a small town.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is not like the Washington Post or New York Journal or whatever, you know. There's no paper out here in the country that's being delivered to the doorstep. You know, ain't no ball riding no bicycle throwing no paper on the front porch down here. So walk in and just do a family like that. I don't understand that. My mama keep the insurance on this house. She keep a roof on this house. She keep these bills paid on this house. You know, my thing is, your house has been here for years. Because of a technicality, you uprooted a family.
Shortly after James Tuggle completed the purchase of the Lewis property last year, the sheriff evicted Michael.
So this is where my trailer was
sitting here. Those are the steps to the front entrance. I called the sheriff. Well, it's his property. He can do with what he wants.
The sheriff saying that Tuggle can do what he wants.
He can do what he wants. It's his property. I suggest you move the trailer. He says, well, that's all I can tell you. Is there anything I can help you with? I told him no.
Michael ended up with a little over $2,800 for his share of the property. He used it to relocate his trailer home to a half-acre lot nearby.
Still got to put in a water line. The water line's across the road. I could be angry to the point that I want to do something to somebody, I mean, you're talking about 125 years of family heritage.
Michael invited us in to see the documents from the local district court that informed them their land was being targeted for sale.
This is a petition that came to us via the sheriff's department. This is the very first document that we received.
You're hereby cited to comply with the demand contained in the petition, which offices in the town of Homer and said Paris State. You have 15
days after
this.
That's a lot of words thrown at somebody that really can't understand some of the lingo, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we get up to the office to find out exactly what it is that they're trying to say.
To make sense of these documents and get a better understanding of what happened to the Lewises, we visited the clerk of court, Brian Flynn.
Anything involving a partition lawsuit is filed here in this office. I'm the custodian of all of these records that you see. So you want to take this out in front?
Yeah, we take it out.
All right, do this.
When it comes to developers, what's the mechanism that they use to track down family members?
Okay, they'll come into this office, and then generally you know the piece of property that you're looking for. You know, whether that is because it's got some timber on it or something of that nature. Then what you do is you can look at the tax assessor's office, and the tax assessor's office will give you just a visual plat, a hand-drawn plat of how the property went from one person to the next person to the next person, and that's how they'll initially find out who owns the property.
So what happened with the Lewises?
The Lewises are a family that is spread out across the United States. So James Terry Tuggle buys into that property. Now, he didn't just buy a sliver of that property. He ended up buying somewhere in the neighborhood of 20%.
Understood.
Once he owns that, yeah, he can force the entire thing to be sold.
And that's what he did.
Which he did.
I smell it.
Over the course of a decade, Tuggle, a timber developer in town, bought the shares of more than 20 people connected to the Lewis property, most of them from out of state. He declined our request for an interview and didn't respond to our written questions.
So the sale happens at the sheriff's office, where it is publicly open for bid, and it's sold for $555,000.
And a bargain of a price, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know, $550,000.
For 500 acres?
Oh, I've seen 17 acres of land sold for $1,800. And believe me, that, you know, that's disturbing.
The sale he's talking about was made in 2001 to a real estate investor named James Steele, who advertises his ability to force the sale of heirs' property. We caught up with him at a sheriff's auction nearby.
All right, suit number 41821, Trigg Investments, LLC versus Maurice Hunter et al. The minimum acceptable bid is $2,294.25. The floor is now open for bids. Do I hear a bid?
A bid cost.
Okay. $2,294.25 is sold. Name right there.
Morning, Jim.
Morning.
How you doing?
Fine.
What just happened today here?
Well, I bought an interest in a piece of land, an undivided interest, you know, when it's inherited and there's a lot of heirs.
Mm-hmm.
I owned 24 acres out of the 52.
Before today you did?
Yes.
And now you came and purchased the rest. How much have you paid in total for 52 acres?
I would have to add that up because, don't get me wrong, I do a lot of these, and I can't keep them all in my head.
Mm. How does heirs' property fit into your overall business model?
To be truthful with it, it's probably 90% of my business model. Even going back to the Civil War, we're doing mm-hmm. some that the people in the Civil War had it. I mean, they were slaves, and they had it. And I've had other landowners come to me and say, well, would you file a lawsuit for me and do this? Because I don't want to be the bad guy. You be the bad guy because you already been the bad guy. You do this all the time.
So I'll be
the bad guy.
You recognize that what you're doing is perceived.
You look at me as evil.
No. I don't know. No, I'm saying no. No, I don't. No. What I'm saying is to the family member that wants to sell, you're bringing the bank. You're bringing the money. To the family member that doesn't want to sell, you're evil.
Probably in their eyes.
Yeah.
And some people are sincere about not wanting to sell. they mean it. Most don't. Most say that, but they don't mean it. They just want instant gratification and money now. But there are some that don't want to sell, and it's usually the ones that live on the property that are getting free rent, free everything.
It's their land. That's not free rent.
Well, they only own a minuscule portion of it. I've heard it thousands of times. You can't make me sell my land. And then I respond back. I said, yes, I can.
But it's my land.
Well, it used to be.
Jim, that ain't real.
The bottom line is what you have is these families who many times owned property for generations, including families who acquired ownership right after the end of the Civil War. Their property rights are instantaneously extinguished, and then they are stripped of a significant amount of their overall wealth, not just their real estate wealth, because African Americans disproportionately who have assets, it's represented in land and homes. So their single greatest asset now has been sold at a fire sale, and they're getting pennies on the dollar.
The way that this system is set up, it seems like it disproportionately affects African Americans who, through legal trickery and threats of violence and lynching and whatnot, land has been taken from them.
Well,
you see what I'm saying?
I hadn't lynched anybody lately, so but and you know, and people like me, I'm at least nefarious. I'm an opportunist. I'm a racist. I've been called everything in the world. Well, I'm not a racist. I don't go after certain things just because you're black or you're Asian or you what.
You're going after the
land. The land. So if everybody in the world could sell a piece of land to their brother or their sister or their son, and nobody could build factories. Nobody could do anything. It would always be out of commerce and never be able to use. There's no remedy to get it back into commerce.
Do you think it's fair?
It has to be. It has to be fair.
Jim Steele wasn't involved in the forced sale of the Lewis property. James Tuggle, the developer who was, let Greg stay on the land, but his mother decided to leave.
This is my mother's house. When she retired, this became her home.
Why did she leave here?
She left here because she was nervous about whether or not her mama's house was going to be pushed down and whether or not her house was going to be next. She couldn't sleep at night. She just didn't feel safe.
Greg's mother, Miss Trudy Stanley, and other members of the Lewis family tried to formalize their ownership when they found out it was being targeted for sale. Mr. Tuggle was years ahead of them in the process and outbid them during last year's auction. Shortly after that, Ms. Stanley moved in with her daughter in Washington, D.C.
It's painful to realize that I don't have it anymore. It's not right. I didn't sell my part of the property. Only someone else came, sold their part, so they affect the whole family. We didn't know the law, so we could protect it, so we lost it like that. Every year, we paid the taxes. We didn't just leave it alone to forget it. We took our resources and made sure we got the taxes paid and everything. That's what we did.
Why do you think your grandfather didn't make a will?
Well, I don't think back during that day they were thinking about making a will, but my grandparents prepared for what he knew at the time and what he had to do at the time, prepare for my family. So I know the difference. Because she needs a will. Because there was going to be chaos in their family.
How important was the land to you?
420 acres of land. It means a lot. And to lose it, you had no defense, you know what to do, lost it. That was devastating. Still is. It will ever, forever be that way. Because that's a loss.
Part of the reason we have in the African American community such a high incidence of heirs property is that when African Americans move from the status of being property themselves to after the Civil War, being able to become landowners,
right,
hardly any of these families were able to structure the ownership in a way that would be stable, because most African American families had
no access to attorneys. And there's studies in various southern states that show that it's somewhere between 10 and 40% of all property African Americans own is heirs' property, because a huge percentage of these families don't have wills or estate plans. And what they know is their property transfers to their heirs. There is a huge racial will-making or estate planning gap. Average white family has 10 times the assets of the average black family. Real estate developers or speculators or investors, they know that. And so what they do is they give a lowball price because they know that the family can't even compete against the lowball price.
According to United States Forest Service research, there's around $28 billion worth of heirs' property in the South. And that's a conservative estimate. Thomas Mitchell drafted legislation designed to help families hold on to theirs. So far, it's passed in 16 states.
So the first provision is, if somebody files one of these lawsuits and requests a court to order the forced sale of the property, what the other owners are then entitled to is to buy out the person who asked for the forced sale. There had been this narrative that black landowners were inevitably going to be extinct by about now. I was like, why are we going to sit back and watch more and more property and land and homes go and then on the back end call for reparations as opposed to trying to stabilize the ownership so that it's not dissipated 20 or 30 years from now?
My family homesteaded these properties. They raise families on these properties. Mr. Tuggle, he ain't gonna build nothing on it. It's all for the timber. All for the timber. Far as you can see on all these hills, this is fresh cut. I mean, right after he purchased, he went to cutting. It was in the family for 125 years.
All of this?
All of this. My aunts and uncles' houses sat up on the top up here. You can see that it's been wiped clean of pine, and everything that you see pushed up, they're gonna come back and burn it and then replant. This is important that you stick together, you keep your interests together, you hold tight to your interests. And if you plan on doing anything with your interests, make sure you do it in the family. Keep it in the family. That's where we fell short. Because whatever they got from him now is probably gone. Just like everything else.
Oh, that audio ran out. Okay, so... Now, for people that want to that's the audio. If you want to see the full, the visual part of it, you can go to our Facebook page, which is DIY Housing TV, DIY Housing TV. Go to our Facebook page, scroll down a little bit, and then it's the first link you'll see. And wait a minute. Matter of fact, what is, let me get it for you. Let's see, go up to Facebook page, DIY Housing TV, excuse me, at Earthwell Forest, but just put in DIY Housing TV, and then scroll down where you'll see, it's two guys sitting on, sitting on some wood, looks like a stack of wood, how property law is used to appropriate black land. Now, it could be anybody's land. You can, like, see the full audio visual on that. And now, one way to, and Friday we'll go into more detail on this, But one way to protect family land is you need to learn how to play what I call financial offense. Typically, you know, if you fell behind on property taxes or got an eviction or foreclosed or whatever, you know, people say, well, you know, they seek legal advice. That's defense. But I always believe that a strong offense is also simultaneously a good defense. So for those the regulars who, you know, when I talk about Mignon Francois, the woman who had seven children, who was sitting in a house with no electricity and no water. Seven kids, mind you. And one day she only had $5 in her pockets, and $5 was set aside so she can feed her family later that day. Oftentimes, they ate at 10 o'clock at night. That's when dinner was served because they didn't have any money until then. But what she did, and her house was in foreclosure. So what did she do? One day, she decided to play financial offense. She took that $5. Now, her way of playing financial offense was cupcakes. And she took the $5, bought materials. I mean, you know, bought the ingredients, really, not materials, but ingredients. Made 60 cupcakes and then took the $5 out, took the $55, and she turned it into $600 by the end of that week. That's financial offense. And then, long story short, she kept on playing financial offense using the cupcake strategy, all right, which is essentially make something and sell it, or get something to sell and sell it. Until she was able to get the lights cut back on, the water cut back on, and made enough money playing financial offense where she was able to get the house out of foreclosure. She still has her house to this day. That's called financial offense. So a lot of people who lose land or lose whatever is they never learn how to play financial offense. A lot of people, they go, let me go get some legal advice. That's playing defense. No, you need to know how to play offense. And if your financial offense is strong enough, then a good offense simultaneously also is a good defense. And you can do that by, like I say, either making something to sell and selling a lot of it, or finding something to sell. I was talking to a guy about an hour and a half ago, and he was telling me about a woman, just a normal, regular, two of them, matter of fact, two normal, run-of-the-mill American women, and one sold her company. I mean, she just basically became a millionaire by selling. She started off with $1,500 that she borrowed from somebody, and she may turn that $1,500 into millions by selling hair. You know, what they call them, bundles or whatever. Because there's a lot of women who buy hair or what have you. She became a millionaire. She didn't create a product. She just found one. And then bought it, found a source where she can buy it at a deep discount. She probably bought it by the pallet or whatever. And became a millionaire that way. Probably in her 30s or something like that, or 20s. And then there's another one that makes $2 million a month. And all this is legal. Selling rolling paper. I mean, like, if you go into a gas station, you see rolling paper. You know, I don't even smoke, and I know there's rolling paper for sale. But, you know, whoever sells rolling paper, at the gas station, 7-Eleven, convenience stores, whatever, $2 million a month on selling rolling paper. So, and I call both of those examples of financial offense. And keep this in mind. There are 20, and this is why I believe truly there's no such thing as financial, you know, the wealth gap. I don't buy into that. Or the, financial, what's the word I'm looking for? Based on the wealth gap based on race. Well, I don't buy into that, man. I mean, here's why. Because for each and every one of us, whether we're on Skid Row and homeless, whether we're living at the Salvation Army and have that kind of temporary shelter for the homeless, whether you're living on Rodeo Drive or somewhere in Beverly Hills or in Mongolia or wherever, everybody on the planet, particularly the ones who are able enough to work, everybody on the planet has 24 hours in the day. The difference between the able-bodied person on Skid Row, the able-bodied person who was homeless, the person, and Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, the common denominator that ties all of us living human beings together is time. There are 24 hours a day for each and every one of us. The woman, now, these are two black women. One decided to go to the source and buy fake hair, bundles, wigs, whatever. She went to a source that manufactured them, which is in Asia, and I imagine bought the stuff at a good price, bought it by the pallet, got it back over in the United States, and became a multimillionaire by selling hair. Okay, fake hair. And the other woman, also black, all right, she found a source to sell rolling paper, and she just got it, gas stations, convenience stores, wherever those outlets. The same 24 hours are in the day for them as in the Skid Row bum or Jeff Bezos and everybody in between. So it comes down to mindset. What are you doing with your 24 hours in a day? There's some people that make $200 a day. There's some people that might make $2 a day. And there's some people that make $2 billion a day. It's all in how you think. So getting back to the piece we just played, for those of you who want to protect your family's wealth, be it in land houses, or whatever it might be, keep in mind there are 24 hours a day, and you need to figure out something in which you can play financial offense with and keep and preserve and protect the family wealth. There's a guy that we brought up on here, his name occasionally, Randy Jones. This guy, he makes tiny houses. He started off with one tiny house. And he had to borrow materials to put that together. So, he built one and for himself and Then the other people came along. Long story short, what Randy does with his 24 hours is he, along with the help of others, you know, he builds 3 to 5 a day. And I think on the low end, he might sell them for like, let's just put it at $20,000. So in an 8-hour period of time, along with his team, you know, might make, you know, if he does 3 in a day, that's $60,000 gross revenue. If he does 5, you know, 20,000 times 5 is 100,000, I mean, gross in a day. In a 10-day period of time, you know, well, yeah. 10-day period of time, it's $1 million gross. That's 2 weeks. Same 24 hours a day. The same 24 hours a day that he had. He had 24 hours a day when he built his first one. He built it by himself. He had to borrow. I think he had to borrow most of the tools, I believe, to build that first one. But then, as he did it more, he found ways to effectively be more efficient with his time. Now Randy really doesn't himself build. You know, he has other people who build. You know, the guy that started Tough Sheds, he started off with, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. No, over 30 years ago. He built one tiny house, shed, tool shed, for himself. Last June or July, he had built. Now, he doesn't participate in the building himself personally anymore, but he had built in one, like last June or July, in 1 month, he had 10,000 built in a month. Now let's break that down. 10,000. Oh, let me clear up my calculator here. 10,000. Let's break this down into 20 working days in a month. So he figured out a way where he can build 500 houses per day, taking the weekends off. Okay, so 500 times 20 days, 10,000. But he broke it down to, and then I'm sure he broke it down, you know, because like he doesn't build it, he doesn't participate in the building himself anymore. He subcontracts out all that work out. You know, a simple way to say is, well, you know, if I find 500 people, 500 carpenters, and each of them does one house. That's one way to break it down. But anyway, in any event, financial offense. So on that note, just food for thought, we're going to revisit this topic more on Friday. And by the way, while it's on my mind, because, you know, I talk about reparations, and I believe there's no less, like just like Baskin-Robbins. Baskin-Robbins reparations, I'll call it. Baskin-Robbins ice cream. There are 31 flavors of Baskin-Robbins ice cream. And they change up flavors from, you know, every so often, probably every month. They got some basics there, but 31 flavors, no less. So I believe there's no less than 31 flavors of reparations. So I'm a big component of do-it-yourself reparations. So in, as far as land preservation, keeping a house in the family, keeping the land in the family, preventing gentrification, is the best way to do it is through do-it-yourself reparations and developing a strong financial offense, which concurrently or simultaneously, rather, is a strong financial defense. Mignon Francois did it through cupcakes. She took that $5 and she's turned that into over $10 million or $10 million in cupcake sales. That's how she did it. Randy Jones is doing it through building of tiny houses. This other lady that I just, 3 hours ago, I didn't know who she was. She does it through selling rolling paper, all legal, rolling paper at gas stations, 7-Elevens, convenience stores. Her strong offense went from zero to $2 million a month in sales. Strong offense equals a strong financial defense. So those are just examples of what I call my definition of DIY, do-it-yourself reparations, regardless of your color or race or religion. All right, that's enough. I'm off my soapbox. Friday we'll come to land preservation again. And Thursday we'll have on as a guest, a repeat guest last week, gentleman that lives in Oakland, California. He took his backyard and he saw the wealth in his backyard. He got two tiny houses put in his backyard, and he makes like $9,000 a month from his backyard. Takes care of himself, his child, and the mother of his child. In Oakland, California, you know, California's expensive. So he'll be back on Thursday. And what he's did, I would call that a strong financial offense, because what we talked about, what was his formula? He bought two tiny houses in his backyard. This is a black dude in Oakland, California, in a working class neighborhood. Okay. Now, the term that you'll hear from us from time to time is, once you find a blueprint, he has a blueprint. Backyard, two tiny houses, and you know how to, this is what he gets from Airbnb. Okay. Backyard, two tiny houses in the backyard, uses Airbnb for his booking. Okay. So with that basic cookie cutter, we talk about wash, rinse, repeat. Now, if he did that, if he repeatedly did that, okay, 111,000 times, actually 111,111 times, he'd have $1 billion a month cash flow. It might take a while to get there, but that's one of the common, once again, there are 24 hours in the day. What are you doing in your 24 hours? If he just steadily does that, and he'll probably have to get some partnerships to do that, you know, but the more partners that he takes on, and they just keep on doing the same thing he did, find a backyard, put two tiny houses on it, market through Airbnb or whatever way you want to market it, and you do it 111,111 times. That's $1 billion in cash flow a month using that basic formula. Once again, he'll be on Thursday. Again, he was on last Wednesday. And he'll be on live, and you can call in and ask him questions. But that's his simple formula. Two tiny houses in his backyard. Now, if you don't have a backyard, so you can partner up with other people, just find a friend, find a relative who's got a backyard, and they're not doing anything with it. Now, you're going to have to split the profits with them. But if you can get up to those numbers of over 100,000, so what? I mean, you're splitting up $1 billion. Everybody's happy. All right, so that's what I call, and that's what, from now on, we're just going to take simple little things and wash, rinse, repeat. What? Rolling papers, people. Next time you go into a gas station, you notice the rolling paper. And I don't even smoke. And I notice those things for sale. $2 million a month. Doesn't wear a suit. The office is probably a smartphone. Another lady, what are you doing with the 24 hours a day? Okay, so and that like I said, we'll go more into the, and we'll give more examples of how to play financial offense, and we're going to have offline, online as well as offline workshops on financial offense, where you can get hands-on experience in real time on the various ways that you can play financial offense. My way will be doing it with the tiny, the tiny house stuff. Anyway, rethink your day, because I'll be working on that, because it was mind-blowing. I said, this woman, all she does is flip hair. Took $1,500, and this other person makes $2 million. I don't even know if she's 40 years old yet. She looked like 20-something or 30-something. But, you're not going to find her on Forbes 400. That's okay. But, anyway, some people are happy with $200 a day. Some people are happy with $2,000 a day. The only distinction is your thinking, your mindset. Okay, let's go to area 309, area code. Your mic is open.
Good morning, LA. Good morning.
Morning, Chris.
I love the fact that we got him coming back in here on Thursday. I got a phone call last night, because here's that perfect example of someone taking an initiative to do something. And I get a phone call, and I'm sure that the lady is listening. And she says, I've got two people, wants two houses each in the backyard to turn them into Airbnbs. Two of them are in Jacksonville, Florida. I don't know where the other two are. But we now have the offer that if anyone needs financing, we have it. So we can finance all of these homes. So anything you want, if you want a business, we can finance. Wanted to throw that on the table this morning. We haven't been
okay. Now, Chris, go in a little bit more detail on how that might work.
Well, I mean, it comes down to each individual person, but we're not looking at your credit score. This is not what this is about. But we do have the ability to finance people on these projects, and we wanted to just get that out there. If you're wanting to be the difference, if you're struggling on cash, we can figure this out. So
for people that are interested to contact you on that, give us your contact information, including social media.
Okay. My phone number is 309-542-6319, and my name is Chris Collins. And social media, of course, you can reach out to DIY Housing. You can reach me on Instagram. It's Chris_Hope_Collins, And I do want you to look through all of the things that I've posted, because everything that's on my Instagram was done by children. Or it's children's futures that are getting changed, like the football team. You'll see things. You'll see things you didn't know that was out there. But this past year, I've been able to implement and make reality out of those things. So now it's time for Saul to get that right. Let's see. You can go to dreamhabitat.org. And you can also go to hopeforhousing.org. And, you know, those are on this, you know, there's a Hope for Housing Facebook page, but I encourage, you know, the DIY Housing TV page, because there is so much information on LA's social media that people need to be interacting and sharing and showing, because everything this man does is about education. He's not here asking for a paycheck. He's here trying to show you how to get one. And he's bringing people that are examples. They're blueprints. They're maybe not your blueprint, but that's because you're unique and you have your own. But maybe you don't know what it is, but maybe you need a little bit of guidance. And that's what this is all about. And if you're not sure what you want, let's talk about it. But there is something that you want to have happen, and that's giving you financial security for you and your family and their future generations of family. And that's what this is about, right? You're trying to teach. And, man, the things you were sitting here, you know, playing for people to just hear these clips, you know, I'm listening to that clip because here's this wealthy man that's wanting just the wood. You know, we're talking 500 acres of this, and he's going to build a house that'll burn. I don't want your house to burn. I don't want you to cut them trees down just because you want a house. Okay? You know, trees catch carbon. You know, and if we look at just in the United States, since 1950, now 100 years ago for a fact, a squirrel could get in a tree in Mexico and go to Canada and never touch the ground. But in 1950, everything changed. But it wasn't prior to 1950 by much that squirrel could do it without a problem. And we've created problems for our animals, for our atmosphere, for everything about what it is. But it is nature is the reason we're here. So we need to think about that and preserve that and not cut down a tree to cover it up with sheetrock and siding. To me, we're talking about the 18th century way of people's thoughts. We might be using 21st century technology getting you that wood, but you don't need to be wood when it could be a washer, dryer, refrigerator, stove, water heater, car, that isn't any good anymore. That can be turned back into a beautiful home that lasts 1,000 years, not worried about the rust happening on the car. Not worried about the engine blowing.
Chris, let me ask you this. Now, the homes that are made from the material you're talking about, metal, they'll last, sound good, but now, can they be assembled or what's the word I'm looking for?
Can they be erected?
Deconstructed. Yeah, because, like, you know, what if, due to political changes, sometimes, you know, let's say the property tax might be a bit much for whatever particular house. So they decide, you know what, we're going to move to another place geographically. So can you deconstruct them with not too much difficulty?
You definitely can. It is an erector set. All you do is you put screws in, put it together, and you take screws out, take it apart. And So, yes, you can deconstruct it. You can pick it up and move it and not deconstruct it, because you can take it apart in sections.
Okay.
Depends on your design. So, now what I want to say is, say you can only afford right now to have a bedroom, a kitchen, it could be an eat-in kitchen, and a little sitting room for your living room and a bathroom. So roughly, let's say, 300 to 400 square feet. And if you had 300 square feet and you had that little square, you were able to live your life. Now, say your family, you met someone. Now your family grew. So you need another bedroom. You pour a foundation next to your house and add it. And whenever you get it built, that's when you take and open it up and make it to where you can now walk through to it. Leave it closed up until then.
Okay.
So that way, you know, you can add a room to this just as easy. It comes down to what is your future and how do you want to design it. And anything you can dream, we can build. If you have a thought in your head, it can be built. That's what I can tell you.
I like that you brought up. I like that you brought that up. You can, because like the audio you've heard it a few times on his solar cabin. What Lamar did was he built a house that he can add on to it if need be. And a lot of people don't think about that when they get into a house.
Definitely. And yeah, you know, we want people to realize that they can have anything they want, but do you have to have it all at once? If you can't afford it, do what you can. You know, if you can't afford two tiny houses in your backyard, you start with one. And that's what he did.
Start with one.
He started with one.
Yeah, he did. He started with one.
And then he built the second. Now, this
correct.
Man that I have in Jacksonville, Florida, that he has a 10-foot or 20-foot by 20-foot concrete slab sitting in his backyard. So he wants a two-story, 8-foot wide, two-story, 20-foot long. So that's 320 square feet. Times two, but right between them is going to be a shared walkway that's covered so that they are shaded and can communicate. So they're going to be separated, but they have like this little breezeway between them. But they're going to go on that. It'll have a 4-foot opening in the front or for that hallway. But it'll have two bedrooms and two bathrooms in it. I do have another floor plan design that is, I'm wanting to say, not even 300 square feet. And it has three bathrooms and two bedrooms and a living room and a kitchen in it. It's a two-story design. But I'm wanting to say it's right at the 300 mark. It's amazing. It was designed by a wonderful person from the University of Munich, Germany. And it was the only design they had ever designed for the U.S. So that university had never designed anything that went over here in the U.S., and they did this one. But they did me a 200-unit complex. It's a beautiful community. It can be built on basically 3 acres with your park. But it still leaves you an acre of green space for this. You got a big, huge, lot of beautiful greenery. So, you know, if people have a little piece of land, you'd be surprised how many people you can serve in your community or outside your community, bringing them in during tourist season. You know, the tourist is most of like Florida's economy. You got your whole coastal situation around the U.S. is tourism. Then they start going into the interiors and you're getting around Branson, Missouri, and all these different places that they built inside so that they could bring money from other parts of the country and give people something to do. And this is the part where we want to offer you anything you want to dream. Let's make it go. You know, all it takes is a piece of land, any land to get started. Your backyard, for example. Your backyard can be paying all your bills. You can quit your 9-to-5 and you can explore what life really is supposed to be about.
Right. Well, this sounds very interesting. Financing, that definitely does help, and that can be a part of a person's cookie cutter, so to speak. Whatnot. So, now you also mentioned yesterday. Say it again.
Right. I was going to say something about the beautiful part about, like, say we're financing this, and you're going and you need to grow. That financing will help you grow, because if you don't have the money, or if you've been able to save the money, you can just build it yourself, or you can pay this thing completely down and be off, and you're now building off of cash. But we'll be able to offer you to build on to your property. So later, you can still finance even the addition. But, yeah, let's
right.
talk about
yesterday.
That's fine.
Okay. Yesterday, you mentioned, the guy, he built a million homes. How long a period? Is it 10 years or whatever? Something like that?
10 years. 10 years they built their technology. They built 1 million homes in Mexico.
That's amazing.
And now they want to build 3 million homes over the next 7 years.
100,000 houses a year.
That gives you 1.2.
Well, that's like 273 houses a day.
Yeah, and I've got a machine that'll produce 500, and I got 15 of them.
Well, we
talk about the 24 hours a day. How many seconds? You know, you come down to the 24 hours a day. How many seconds is that? Now, every second, each of those machines make 2 feet of material per second. So,
yeah,
if you
machines
want to look at
don't get tired.
Or not, what's that?
Machines do not get tired. People get tired, but machines don't.
Correct. They don't complain either.
They don't complain. They're not a part of the union. So that's
sometimes
where the
they
ball's
might be
going.
Moody, though. Some of them are temperamental.
That's where the ball is. That's where the ball is going. Because, I even noticed it at Walmart. There's a self-check. The self-checkout area has expanded, at least to 2 or 3 Walmarts that I bounce in every month. So the self-checkout, DIY, that has expanded. They might have one employee that you will assist anybody that might need it. Then you'll see rows of, you know, where you can regular checkout lanes. Those are empty, and they might have two where, they're servicing people. But I have noticed that, the DIY section has expanded. And I'm sure somewhere they are doing beta tests with robots that will check you out.
Yeah, the self-checkouts, they are running everything now. And in the same distance of a lane that on the normal store and for people to check out, it takes up so much square footage of the floor. And in the same lane, they can have 2, 3, or 4 checkout lanes going in that same square footage. So you have 4 people checking out, and you're not paying the person to check them out. You have a computer that's with a camera, and it watches the items, and they weigh them when they hit the thing.
Exactly.
And they also have, even
for theft prevention, because if you try to leave out of Walmart without paying for whatever item, that alarm goes off.
Yep. If it has not been rang out of that register, it will not let you out the door.
Exactly.
That's a fact. And
yep.
Because people need to look at what has Walmart transitioned to? Walmart has transitioned to a 100% service industry. They're providing you products,
you can go
and look around and do all that, or you can set it your house and order it, and you can either have it delivered to your house, or you can show up outside Walmart and not even get out of your car. And they will load it and shut your door, and you go back home. And that did not cost any more money than for me to walk in there and do that.
That's
now,
true.
The one thing that they have, instead of people at the register, they now have people running out shopping for you.
Yep. Well, if you use the app on your phone or whatever device, DoorDash, because DoorDash is basically a system of people that will shop for you. You just wait, and they'll pick it. They'll shop it and bring it to your front door.
I'll give the radio listeners something to research. Research. A company back in 2002 called Carry Out Express.
Yeah, we can do that with houses, Chris. That can be done with houses.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
Yeah, it can be done with houses. Yeah.
Download an app and then have people build your house. And then, they could deliver it to you, or if it's on a piece of land or whatever, you can go to it.
We definitely can. But, yeah, I didn't know if you heard that or not, but that Carry Out Express was a company that delivered for every restaurant. And That was something I had in 2002. I was the COO of that company. And I went and I did Good Morning America with Diane Sawyer 2 days after my 30th birthday, right there on Times Square. But I went to Congress and talked to them about that company. If people think about what our number one industry in the world is food. That is the number one commodity. Okay. If you stayed at work and you ordered something to eat and you got paid while you were at work, instead of taking the time off, spending the gas, the energy and everything, losing your parking place, and having to get back here to get back to work. If you saved all that energy and stayed productive and did something. You got paid for. Now you just bought your lunch. Now you can have anything you want. Have it higher, faster, and fresher than you can go to get it yourself. And that was the concept behind it. But what my concept was to give every person in the United States a share of it. So that way, this started that generational wealth. But it's servicing our workers. But then we could bring it to the households. But the tax revenue alone from the one company doing every major city in the country was taking our national debt and paying it down in 2 years. And okay. Every other company in the taxes continue to do whatever else. That one company, if it did that and serviced every worker and then serviced the homes that wanted stuff delivered, the tax revenue from that would take our trillions of dollars and just deplete it. And I went to Congress and I spoke to them right there in the Capitol building. I was on my way to go see Bush when my cousin got a phone call and his wife just lost her twins. And I looked at the Secret Service and told them, I said, I got to take him home. And they whistled for a cab, put me in it, went to the Days Inn, got our stuff, put it in the car, and I drove him back to Bloomington, Illinois. But when I got back here, that's when the bank didn't follow through and give me my 100 vehicles I already had leased and set up. They said, Chris, they didn't even have my business plan. They said they'd never seen a business plan that couldn't lose money. I showed a business plan that if I had one vehicle working in this city and I had 99 of them parked, that one vehicle would make the payment on all 99 of those other ones. And all that disappeared and it wound up becoming what you guys use today. So what I'm sharing with you today, I'm trying to give you anyway. So you don't have to try to take it. Just take it and take advantage of it. That's all I'm going to say to that. You know, that's why I walked away from Profit in 2005. That was the second business. The other guy, it was a drywall business. But I was tired of my life being taken away from me. That's why I gave it away.
Okay.
But now I'm here to offer and share what I do today. Give me a little more history of me.
Okay. Okay, well, let's see. Any special projects coming up, Chris?
Well, be looking to come in toward Jacksonville in the next 2 weeks. And I am needing more orders. So, the more the merrier here. I'd like to bring at least 10 houses with me when I come so we can set some stuff up. You know, if we can get a project going in the next 2 weeks on the Hamilton property, that would be wonderful. This is what it's about. There is a move happening. Somebody has stepped up. We do have 4 houses going. And I've got some people in Georgia that are wanting some homes as well. So I'm going to be having a conversation here in a few minutes with that. They're wanting me to be in Kansas City this week. Of course, I'm having vehicle issues here with my personal vehicle, so I'm working on setting it up so I have a way to get back and forth right now to make that happen because, you know, they want 3 million homes in the next 7 years. That's going to make a difference in every community across this country because they're not looking to send these out all over the world, per se. They want to fix the problems that are here today.
Right. All right. Well, I'll be probably calling you late this afternoon on that financing stuff. And like I say, Thursday we have a repeat guest on. What the tiny house guy? He'll be back on. But explain, break down his cookie or what he would call house hacking. That's how to basically get the maximum amount of, at least pump some type of additional income out of your house that, you know, you normally might not would have done. So he'll be on Thursday, And Friday we'll revisit the land theft again, probably going into more detail, but we, including the financial offense, including online and offline classes that will be we're ready to do now. So we just had to set, we'll probably start those off on a Thursday. And what, today's Tuesday? So, well, you know, hopefully we can get something going this Thursday. In any event, everyone have a good rest of the day.